Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Ted Staunton. Each week, we visit with a local author, get an introduction to their work and a glimpse into their lives. We try to find out what prompts them to write, and we give them an opportunity to read from their work. So today, we're very pleased to welcome Ted.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Ted Staunton is a very well-known author of children's stories who lives in Port Hope. He published his first book, Puddle Man, in 1983, and has been entertaining and stimulating children's imagination with his books ever since. Having originally trained as a teacher, he has very naturally stepped into the role of speaker, performer, and workshop leader for children in schools and libraries across Canada. Besides this, he teaches writing for children courses at George Brown College and the Halliburton School for the Arts. Your first book, Puddleman, Ted, was a picture book for the under fives. What inspired this story, and why do you think it's remained such a favorite with readers?
Well, the story, Felicity, was inspired by a project I had to do while I was doing my teacher training. I took an optional course about writing for kids, and on the very first day of the class, the professor told all the students that we had a choice. We could write an essay about the genre, or we could take a stab at writing something ourselves. And then she proceeded to read us a very short picture book. Somebody asked, how long does the essay have to be? And she said, oh, I think 10,000 words ought to do it. And everybody looked back towards the picture book, and you could just see everything. I know what I'm going to do. So I wrote the Puddle Man book as an assignment for that class. And the teacher actually gave us some very good advice about how to get started. She said, don't make it cute. Write about things that kids actually do. And she said, keep in mind that a well-written book is not a book just for kids. It's a book that entertains everybody. She said, make sure that you like this too, because otherwise you're talking down to your audience. So anyway, I created the Puddle Man story and handed it in to avoid writing 10,000 words.
I wish I'd been given the option when I was doing teacher training. Nothing so interesting happened to me.
It was a good deal, let me tell you. It's the best thing that happened to me while I was there.
So, as an unknown new author at the time, was it difficult to interest publishers in your book?
Well, I didn't know a thing about how one got published. It had always been something that lurked in the back of my mind as something I wanted to try. But the professor, we all handed in these assignments, and the professor gave me a sort of tantalizingly good mark, and she had implied that in the past some of these things had been published. And that was enough bait to hook me. So I, you know, with a lot of trepidation, I approached her and said, do you think maybe possibly this might, you know, how would I? And she said, not a problem, she said. I have a third cousin by marriage twice removed or something like that. And she said, try this publisher and tell them I sent you. Well, I thought, why not? Now, this was the early 1980s, and so I stuffed the original manuscript, which was had illustrations and so on, into an envelope, and I just toddled down the street from the U of T to the address of this publishing company. I didn't know it, but I was breaking every rule in the book. You know, I was handing in an illustrated manuscript. It was the only copy I had. I was approaching them in person instead of sending an inquiry by mail. Just, you know, you name it, I did it wrong. I don't know. I had never been to a publisher's before, so I was kind of expecting sort of New York. I was thinking some exposed brick, potted palms, a lot of natural wood, big, you know, wall to, you know, floor to ceiling windows, people in three-piece suits. And instead, I get to this place, and it's so small, it doesn't even rate its own number. It was 585 and a half, Bloor Street West. So I climb two flights of stairs. So every stair creaks, so they know you're coming, see. And I get to the top, and there's no landing at the top. I knock on the door, and the door opens about an inch, and there's an eye looking out of the crack in the door. And there's a voice that comes with the eye, and the voice says, what do you want? And I went into my spiel. Hi, I'm Ted, and the professor was there. So told me to ask for so-and-so, and I'm like, do you want to read it? And there was a pause, and the eye looked it up and down, the manuscript in the envelope, and then the voice said, Is that a stamped self-addressed envelope so we can mail it back to you when we don't like it? And I said, no. But I had a pen, so I hastily scrawled my name and address on the envelope, and I had some money in my pocket, so I said, how about I give you money for postage? What do you think, a dollar? And the eye looked the manuscript over again and said, looks heavy, give me two. So I handed over $2, the manuscript, a hand came out from underneath the eye, seized them both, the door slammed in my face. I went home. The next day, I got a special delivery letter from the publisher saying, we liked your story. Come on in, let's talk. So I went all the way back downtown, and I climbed the stairs, and every one of them creaked, and this time the door bolts rattled and changed, and the entire door was flung open, and there was a person attached to the eye, and she said, come on in, Ted, how good to see you, have a coffee. And I just sat right down, and they said, all right, here's a contract, let's do this and do that, and I was on top of the world. But at any rate, that's how I got started. I had no idea how lucky I was. It was the right place and the right time.
And it was your lucky day.
It was absolutely my lucky day.
And then since then, you've written over 30 books for different ages, too, from preschool to young adult. Some of them humorous and some serious. What draws you to writing for such a wide spectrum?
Partly it's economic. When your audience changes about every 5 years, you have to keep a flow of material coming out. A single publisher or even multiple publishers couldn't cope with, say, even if I had the ideas or the material, 3 or 4 picture books by Ted every year. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, you have to speak to a broader audience than one age group or genre could accommodate. The other thing is, of course, it's much more fun. I would say of all the work that I've done, writing picture books is the hardest. But, nonetheless, it keeps you on your toes if you move from a novel for teens to a comic piece for kids in grades 2 or 3, back to a picture book, back to this. It keeps the writing muscles in good shape.
Yes. So how about reading for us? And what about reading from Who I'm Not, which I really enjoy?
Oh, thank you. And what I thought I might do is read to you a little bit of the first chapter. This is based on a true story that took place in the 1990s. In the true story, an amazing, odd story, a 20-something man from France claimed to be a missing teenager, a missing adolescent from Texas. And he ended up in Texas successfully impersonating this missing child for about 6 months before it all unraveled. I've written a novel with that basic idea, but I took it many steps further. I wanted to write about a teenager who claims to be a missing child. He's an American. He comes to Port Hope claiming to be a child who went missing in the Grafton area. And my character, in fact, literally does not know who he is. He's a child who was abandoned at birth. So taking on different personae is almost second nature to him. It's easier to tell you who I'm not. I'm not Kerry Ludwig or Sean Callahan. I'm not David Alvarez or Peter McLeod or Frank Rolfe. Kind of wished I was them, but even though I've been all those guys, none of them was me. And I'm not Danny Delamondo either, no matter what I said. If I were Danny, I wouldn't be telling you this, would I? I mean, I couldn't. The only reason I became him was because Harley died. We were working this high-end mall in Tucson. Harley was doing switchbacks on debit card pin machines. I was decoying. He'd lifted the store's machines the month before. Harley had switched them for ones he'd gotten from this guy, Dennis. The plan was Dennis's machines would store up a whole month's worth of PIN numbers and info. Then when we switched them back, Harley could download it all and tap into these rich people's bank accounts. They'd still notice, even if they're rich, I said. Nah, Harley told me, that's the beauty part. With so many numbers, you just store a little bit over and over from each one. They don't notice. And if somebody does, who cares? You've still got all the rest. It adds up to major coin. We weren't getting cut into the major coin. We were hired hands. Dennis was paying straight cash for the switches. We moved around a lot, so even if they ever did look at the security videos, nobody would recognize us. Harley said we were going to Seattle as soon as Dennis paid up. The clothing stores were routine. I'd go in first, get the clerk away from the desk to help me pick something for my mom's birthday. Then I'd say I'd forgotten what her size was and promised to come back. I liked decoying. People got right into it. Probably because most of them think teenagers are supposed to be all attitude. If they really got into it, I'd take a while. I didn't have to. Harley only needed a few seconds. But it was nice. I could tell I was making their day. I'd make up all kinds of stuff until I half believed it myself. Feeling good is what we sell, Harley liked to say when we were scamming. If a store lady was really nice to me and was about the right age, I'd tell her she should be my mother. That would always make her laugh and get blushy so you could tell she liked it. Once in a while, I'd find myself wondering if she was my mother. Maybe even wishing it a little bit, you know? Which is strange because I've imagined lots of parents, but I never saw them working in a store. Outside, after, I remember Harley stopped to put on his two-tone shades and settle the collar of his yellow polo shirt over his blazer. Then he adjusted the cuffs of the blazer, too, so his big silver watch showed. Harley was just so about everything, especially his hair. He was getting thin on top, and he was short enough that you'd notice. He had an empty laptop case and a little gym bag he'd stashed the pin machines in. He looked like Joe Business just done a workout. He took out a pack of gum and popped in a couple of pieces, and we started across the parking lot for the van. "Good day's work," Harley said around his chewing. "How much will Dennis pay?" I asked. "I'll handle that." Harley didn't look at me while we walked. I knew he was scoping out the parking lot for incidental action. Hey, Harley said, "check it out. You see him? Fat boy." I knew by now what to look for. Sure enough, two rows of cars over, a lumpy guy with spiky hair was huffing and puffing, a big bag from the mall's stereo store in each hand. "Go," Harley said, chewing faster. "Good car, we do it." It was the key game. Easy and just exciting enough to be fun. I peeled away, hustled through the heat and the parked cars to the road just past Fat Boy, and I slowed down and stayed behind him. He stopped at a black Lexus. Perfect. I ducked down. I heard his door locks click open. I saw him sling the stuff into the back seat. He was sweating in the sun. You could see the dark patch where his shirt stuck to his back. He opened the driver's door, and as he got in, I crept to the car right behind his. Harley was strolling in front of the Lexus now, pretending to look at his big watch from behind his shades. Fat Boy reached for his shoulder belt. I stood up. I stepped forward. Harley looked up from his watch. "Hey!" he yelled to Fat Boy. Hey! He rapped on the car's hood, and he pointed. "He's keying your car!" Fat Boy freaked. He was scrambling around so much that Alexis started rocking. Then he tumbled out all red-faced and wild-eyed. He was yelling, "Hey, you little!" I froze at the back on the passenger side, as if I was scared stiff. Really, I was counting to three. He came at me. I ran. It was no problem to outrun him. I'm small for my age. All I had to do was distract him long enough for Harley to scoop everything and get away. Then I'd loop back to the van and we'd be gone. I could hear Fat Boy gasping behind me, the slap of his loafers on the pavement. We were far enough away by now. "Never look back," Harley always said, but I did it this once as I sped up. Fat Boy's face was purple. He stumbled. His hand came up. There was something in it. It could have been a BlackBerry. It could have been a gun. That scared me. I yelled as I dodged around a monster SUV. Two rows of cars over, I glimpsed Harley's head. It snapped around at the sound of my voice. Then I heard three things all in a row. A horn blare, brake shriek, and this muffled clunk, like something falling over in a closet. Then Harley was dead.
Thanks, Ted. It's a great beginning to the story.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now.